I want to start today by wrapping up and reviewing the hypothalamic anterior pituitary axis. Now, that is outlined on 21B. I don't think you really need it for this discussion, but if you have it, it's on 21B. And we're going to then talk about the thyroid, which is on 21C. If you want either of those, we have handouts up here. Is this too loud? Put it lower?
No, you're listening.
Yeah, I know, there's some feedback. I don't know. If you turn it up, you get feedback. So I'm going to turn it down a little bit. Okay. So, to go back to the hypothalamic anterior pituitary axis, if you have the hypothalamus, or the HT, it secretes releasing factors or releasing hormones and some inhibitory factors which affect the anterior pituitary. For this part, we're ignoring the posterior pituitary. And then the anterior pituitary, so these are releasing hormones. And then the anterior pituitary secretes what are called trophic hormones, which stimulate glands. And that's either the adrenal cortex, these are the glands that are stimulated, or the gonads, or the thyroid. And then these in turn produce hormones, which actually do something. So we know that the gonads produce estrogens, androgens, etc., or sex hormones. The thyroid produces thyroid hormone. And the adrenal cortex produces several things, but the two main ones, which are listed on your handout, are cortisol and aldosterone. Now, these are examples, but the major examples, of two classes of hormone. That cortisol is involved in stress, and it's also involved in glucose metabolism. So cortisol is called a glucocorticoid. There are several others, but cortisol is the major one. And its production is controlled by the hormone, the tropic hormone, from the anterior pituitary. However, aldosterone controls mineral metabolism, sodium and potassium. We'll concentrate on sodium. But it controls the ionic composition of the body fluids. And so it's called a mineralocorticoid. And these kinds of hormones, the mineral corticoids, are not controlled by input from the anterior pituitary. They're controlled, so this one's controlled primarily by ACTH input to the adrenal cortex. But this one's controlled in a different way. There's a feedback loop so that the mineral composition triggers the production of aldosterone appropriately, and we'll talk about that next time. So it's a separate loop. Now, the adrenal cortex also makes a small amount of weak androgens, primarily at puberty, and we've left that off. And those are also under the control of ACTH, but we're going to concentrate on these two. So, what do you call these tropic hormones? The one that controls the adrenal cortex is called either ACTH or corticotropin. And the ones that control the gonads are called gonadotropins. And the one that controls the thyroid is called thyrotropin. Now, all these things have multiple names, sad but true. The one we're going to talk about the most is thyrotropin. And because it stimulates the thyroid, it's also called thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH. With the thyroid, there are three hormones that are known respectively. These are on your handout, by the way. They're on handout C from last time. and we'll talk about them some more in a minute, that there is TRH, TSH, and TH. And it's clear from this that TH is thyroid hormone, TSH is thyrotropin or thyroid gland stimulating hormone, and TRH is thyrotropin releasing hormone. And each one activates the next. We'll get back to what thyroid hormone does in a minute. Now, we said last time that the anterior pituitary makes these tropic hormones, and it also makes what we call pseudotropic hormones, which we put over here. And these were growth hormone. These are listed under other hormones on 22B, 21B. Growth hormone and prolactin. And that similarly to the tropic hormones, these stimulate a target organ, not necessarily a gland, but the mammary gland in the case of prolactin, and the liver in the case of growth hormone. And that each of these releases a secretion. So just as the thyroid, the gonads, and the adrenal cortex secrete something, in response to growth hormone or prolactin, their targets secrete something. But as we said last time, the liver makes insulin-like growth factors, and the mammary gland makes milk, which is an exocrine, not an endocrine secretion. Now, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, at least mention, is the types of receptors that some of these use. Now, it's not the releasing hormones, but the tropic hormones. I misspoke last time. The tropic hormones all use G-protein-coupled receptors, and they all affect the cyclic AMP pathway. On the other hand, where are the receptors for these tropic ones? They're going to be on the surface. They're surface receptors, G-protein-coupled receptors. And those are multi-pass proteins. On the other hand, the secretions are all lipid-soluble. They're either steroids or steroid-like. So when they act on their target tissues, where will those receptors be? Those are going to be intracellular. Those are going to be those transcription factor receptors that are going to go and affect transcription. So there's one more type of receptor involved here. We've assumed that when you have receptors for signaling molecules, they're either internal for the lipid-soluble signals, or they're on the surface for water-soluble signals, proteins, peptides, and water-soluble molecules. But surface receptors actually come in two main types, and we've talked about one, which are the G-protein coupled receptors. But there's another large class of surface receptors that do not use G-proteins, that they have in catalytic domains. And the most famous of those, which we've mentioned before, are receptor tyrosine kinases, also known as TK receptors. This stands for tyrosine. And one of the things we'll do today is we'll explain a little bit about how these work, because we were never able to fit it in before. Now, on 21C, there's one other class. There's something called other hormones. And besides these two, there are some other hormones. And I'm not going to talk about those. They're not as well known, and their function is not as well understood. But the only thing I want to say about those that you should be aware of is that those proteins are made by alternative processing of a single protein. So that it turns out you have a single long protein which is cut up to make ACTH, and the remainder of it is cut up, not always the same way, in different tissues to make the other hormones. And the reason for bringing this up is that we've already discussed that you might have to process a protein after you've made it. You might have to remove methionine. You might have to remove the signal peptide. You might have to phosphorylate it. You might methylate it like a histo. So you do modify and alter proteins. Just like you process RNA, you process proteins. And this is one more example. And not only do you process this big protein, but there is a case of alternate processing. Just like you can cut up the same transcript to make different messenger, you can cut up and splice a transcript to make a different collection of messenger RNAs. You can cut up a big protein sometimes to make a different collection of peptides or hormones that have different effects. And if you're interested in more details, there's some in the notes and others in the texts. Okay, so this sort of covers the big picture of all the different major hormones and where they come from. And what I want to look at a little more closely is the regulation of this three-step operation. It turns out that multiple feedback loops here, of which we're going to talk about some of them, because the amount of hormone produced here in response to the tropic hormones is actually regulated. The amount of insulin or the amount of glucagon is not regulated. Nobody cares how much you have. As long as you keep your glucose under control, big deal. But the amount of thyroid hormone or cortisol or the estrogen and the hormones made here are in fact regulated. And we're going to use the example of the thyroid to explain how this is and to some extent why it is. So you want to look now at 21C, which has a diagram of all the pieces of thyroid function and synthesis that we want to look at. Now the thyroid picture is in a way just this one right here for the thyroid. But we'll redraw it to make it clearer. So you have the hypothalamus, you have the anterior pituitary, and you have the thyroid. And then at the bottom, you have your target cells. So the hypothalamus makes a releasing hormone, which in this case is thyrotropin releasing hormone, or TRH. And that combines with receptors on the anterior pituitary. And that triggers the production of TSH, or thyroid stimulating hormone, or thyrotropin. And that binds also to receptors on the outside of the thyroid, because both TSH and TRH are proteins. They're water-soluble, and they bind to surface receptors. But the thyroid then, in response, releases thyroid hormone. And thyroid hormone is not water-soluble. Its structure is actually shown on the top, and we'll explain it in a minute. And so it binds to receptors inside its target. Now, what does thyroid hormone do? Thyroid hormone is required during development for a proper outcome. If you don't have enough thyroid hormone, not only do tissues not grow properly, but the brain doesn't develop properly, which is very serious business. And thyroid hormone contains iodine. The most common problem with not having enough thyroid hormone is due to a lack of iodine. People who live in the parts of the world where there is no fish and no seaweed tend not to get enough iodine. And that's why, for example, in the United States, the salt is iodized. Because by iodizing salt, virtually everybody gets enough iodine, and nobody grows up stunted and mentally deficient because of a lack of thyroid hormone. Now, in the adult, though, thyroid hormone stimulates growth of many cells, and it controls basal rate of metabolism. That means the rate of metabolism when you are at rest. It's measured by measuring how much oxygen you use up when you're at rest. So the basal metabolic rate is in fact controlled by thyroid hormone. And if you have too much thyroid hormone, all of your metabolism runs too fast, you get hot all the time, you sweat, you're hyperactive. If you don't have enough thyroid hormone, your metabolism is too sluggish, you're cold all the time, etc. So the actual level of thyroid hormone is regulated. It is maintained within limits at a constant level. And how is that done? That's done largely by negative feedback. So if you look at your handout, you see that we have drawn a line here. Most of the major feedback is at the level of the anterior pituitary. So there is feedback here, negative feedback, meaning that the thyroid hormone inhibits the anterior pituitary from making TSH. And the primary effect seems to be that thyroid hormone prevents the synthesis of receptors for TRH. So it causes TRH receptor synthesis to decrease. It may have other effects as well. Remember we talked before about estrogen? We said it's not uncommon for a hormone to affect the synthesis, a steroid hormone, a lipid-soluble hormone, to affect the synthesis of receptors for other hormones. Now, in addition, there may be feedback as well, although it's not as significant on the hypothalamus. That's why this one's a dotted line on your hand. Now, notice this means that if you have a high level of thyroid hormone, you will cut back on the amount of TSH, stimulation of the thyroid and production of thyroid hormone. Similarly, you probably also prevent the hypothalamus from making TRH. So you cut down on the stimulus, and the thyroid makes less thyroid hormone. Now, there are many diseases and problems that come from mistakes with this system. It is not at all uncommon for people to have problems of too much thyroid, not enough. In fact, after teaching about this for several years, I myself developed hyperthyroidism. And I wasn't entirely unhappy because I lost weight. But since it can have many other consequences, I went to the doctor and had it treated. Now, if you want to know how you do that, I'll tell you later, but I don't want to go into it now. So one of the common things that can happen as a sign of thyroid malfunction is to develop goiter. Goiter is due to an enlarged thyroid gland. The thyroid gland is at the base of your neck. And so if it's enlarged, you have like a large growth or a lump at the base of your neck. And this is actually relatively easy to treat, but it turns out that there are two goiters which are due to different, entirely different conditions, and you have to know which it is in order to treat it properly. That goiter can be caused in the presence of high thyroid hormone, or it can occur in the presence of low thyroid hormone. This is called hypothyroid goiter, and this is hyper. So hyper just means overactive. Hypo is underactive. So if your thyroid's underactive, you don't make enough thyroid hormone. Now, how do you explain the presence of goiter in this one, which is maybe easier? If there's low TH, what should happen? You don't make enough thyroid hormone, and the most common cause of that is lack of iodine. If you don't have iodine, you can't make thyroid hormone. So if there's no thyroid hormone, you're not going to have any negative feedback. So that means that you're going to continue to make TSH and stimulate the thyroid to grow. So the thyroid will grow, but it can't make any more thyroid hormone. So it just keeps growing and growing. The break is broken. There is no break on the growth of the thyroid. Yeah?
But does TSH cause the release of T3 and T4? In that way, making it grow?
What does TSH do? TSH stimulates the growth of the thyroid and virtually all the steps in making thyroid hormone, which we will go through in a minute.
Okay, so just stimulating means growth, if it's not.
Stimulating means it doesn't mean just stimulating the release of hormone, but all of the steps in the synthesis and release of hormone, and as well the growth of the organ, the gland as well. Okay. So this is a sort of broken break, failure of inhibition mutation. Now, how can you get, we understand how if there's no negative feedback, you could get overgrowth of the thyroid and you could get goiter. But how does it happen in the presence of TH? You continue to pour out TH, but it doesn't turn off making more TH. Well, one explanation is there's just something wrong with the negative feedback loop. The receptors don't work right. You have thyroid hormone, but the signal is not received. But another way it can happen, which is probably more common, is that the thyroid is overstimulated because one example is a tumor. If you have a tumor of too much that makes too much TRH, or a tumor that makes too much TSH, then you will continue to stimulate the thyroid whether you get negative feedback or not. Perhaps the most common cause of hyperthyroidism and a goiter is what is called Graves' disease. And this occurs, this is an autoimmune disease, and it occurs when you make antibodies to the TSH receptor. So you have antibodies to the TSH. So if we look at our picture, where is our TSH receptor? This is our TSH receptor. Now normally, when you have antibodies to a protein, the antibodies combine with the protein and knock the protein out of commission. The protein no longer functions. But this is an exceptional case because the antibodies to this receptor actually act like the ligand. They activate the receptor. So they bind to the receptor, and the receptor changes conformation as if it had bound TSH. So the antibodies act as an agonist of TSH. Since the antibodies stimulate the receptor, the thyroid makes thyroid hormone. Well, what will the thyroid hormone do? That will go and inhibit the anterior pituitary, so you stop making TSH. Even though you stop making TSH, the antibodies will stimulate the thyroid in its absence, and it will continue to pour out thyroid hormone. Now you notice the difference. In one of these cases, TSH will be low, and one of these cases, TSH will be, in fact, high. So there are many problems in the problem book and many real problems in medicine where there are abnormalities of this, and you have, by looking at the various levels of the substances involved, you can figure out where the problem is and do something about it. Now, I want to move on and talk about the actual structure and synthesis of thyroid hormone, but first let me ask if there are questions about this. So if not, we want to look at the top of the handout. And on the top of the handout, we've drawn the structure of thyroid hormone and how it's made. Now, thyroid hormone, or T4, which is the one which is shown there, is a modified form of tyrosine. And it's shown on the upper right. It's really two tyrosine side chains connected to each other, connected to COOH. And it has four iodines on it. One, so this is called T4. And this is the form of thyroid hormone, or thyroxin, which is made by the thyroid gland. People also have what is called T3, which is missing one of these iodines on the top. T3 may be the biologically active form, but it's formed later by removal of an iodine. Now, this is a lipid-soluble compound. So, if you made it, could you hold on to it? And the answer is no. With all lipid-soluble signal molecules, you make them in response to need. Because once you make them, they go through the membrane and out into the bloodstream. You can't hold on to them. It's different with water-soluble hormones and signaling molecules. You can put them inside a vesicle and save them until you want them, and then have exocytosis when you need them. Now, the thing is, you don't eat, even a person who lives near the ocean doesn't eat iodine all the time. And so you'd like to have a way of storing this up so that you had a reserve of iodine-labeled stuff. If you went on a trip away from the ocean, you wouldn't have a problem. And in fact, you have a way of doing that. The way that you make this hormone is you first make a protein called thyrotropin. Excuse me, thyroglobulin. I misspoke. Thyroglobulin. And thyroglobulin has a lot of tyrosines in it. Now, an enzyme in the thyroid does the chemical reaction shown on the left of cutting off the side chain of one tyrosine and connecting it to another. And then additional enzymes. First you add on the iodine. That's one enzyme. And then another enzyme moves the iodinated side chain onto another one. So what that means is, in your thyroid, you have modified thyroglobulin. The thyroglobulin has T4, but the T4 is tied down because this end is part of a peptide chain. So when it's time to release thyroid hormone, an enzyme comes along and cuts the peptide chain. Remember the processing? It cuts out the T4, separating it from the two amino acids on each side of it, and now the T4 can be released. So your modified thyroglobulin is a reserve of T4. Now, where and how do you make it? That's what that little picture on the right shows you, on the bottom right. Your thyroid gland consists of a collection of follicles. Each follicle is like a grape, and they're all together in a bunch. And each follicle itself, or grape, is really a hollow ball. So it really looks like this. In cross-section, one follicle looks like that. And you have a lot of them in the thyroid gland. Now, what the picture shows is a little, like a quarter of a follicle blown up. So here's the lumen, or the space inside the follicle. And that's where thyroglobulin is modified and stored. Now, how does this work? In the cells surrounding the follicle are sort of ordinary type epithelial cells, as in any gland, and they synthesize proteins to be secreted on the rough ER. So thyroglobulin, plain, no iodine, unmodified, is made on the rough ER and goes into a vesicle. And then by exocytosis, that vesicle releases thyroglobulin into the lumen. Here it is with its tyrosines. Now, the enzymes that are inside the lumen do the modifications. They add on the iodine, and then they cut and move the side chain onto the next, so that you now have thyroglobulin, which I've written this way, and you would also have T4. So you would have attached T4. Now, that sits around waiting. In response to TSH, all of these steps are stimulated, as is the growth of the follicle, increase in cell number and size. And you now have to cut this up. So in response to TSH, how are you going to cut up this protein to release individual molecules of thyroid hormone? That happens inside lysosomes. Now, the lysosomes aren't in the lumen. The lysosomes are in the cells of the follicle. So now what happens is endocytosis thyroid hormone, the modified thyroglobulin, is taken up into vesicles, and then these vesicles fuse with a lysosome. And now the enzymes inside the lysosome can cut up the thyroglobulin, releasing T4. And once that happens, the T4 can be released. Now, T4 is lipid-soluble. It can get out of the cell by passing through membranes, but it's not soluble, so it can't just float around in the blood. All lipid-soluble hormones and substances in the blood are associated with proteins. They are stuck to proteins, and it's the complex that floats around. Some substances have a specific protein partner, and some substances just bind to a common blood protein. T4 binds to a specific protein in the blood and is carried around. Now, the only thing I didn't say is how do you get the iodine in there? And you notice there's one other little thing in your handout. If you look again, you'll see over here that iodine uptake requires a specific transport protein, which is in the plasma membrane, and its uptake requires ATP. And then the iodine can, as far as I know, simply diffuse through the cell. I don't know what kind of transport protein is here and reach the lumen. But iodine uptake does require energy in the form of ATP. If you don't have iodine, what happens is you make thyroglobulin, but you can't modify it. Now, we've talked about this because it involves basically every process we ever discussed in this class all at once. And I want to leave it now and talk about, this is one feedback loop, one sort of cycle. And we see now how you make thyroid hormone, how it stimulates other cells, and how you keep from making too much thyroid hormone. But I want to leave it and talk about some other hormone cycles. So let me ask what questions there are before we go on.
Is the iodine put on the VR, or it only gets put on in the lumen?
Where do you add the iodine? The iodine is added in the lumen.
So at least just as a peptide.
That's right. So you make a... The question is, the peptide itself is made like any other secreted peptide on the rough ER, put into a vesicle, and then it's secreted essentially into the lumen. Yes?
So TSH activates all steps of this process?
TSH activates virtually all the steps of this process. That's correct. Yes? How do you get out of the lysosome into the blood? Once the protein is cut up, T4 is itself lipid-soluble. So T4 can presumably pass all the membrane barriers needed to reach the blood. Yes?
What is the amplification law? Can one molecule of TSH release 10 molecules of T4?
Okay, the question is, what is the amplification here? And I don't know the answer to that. I assume it's significant at each stage, but I don't know the science. Okay. So on your next handout, on A for today, on 22A, we have on A and B two examples of cycles using hormones or of circuits where you get something done using hormones, those hormones that we've already talked about. And so I thought it would be worth looking at them briefly. And on A, we have lactation, which we already mentioned, but we didn't do the actual setup. So just as the thyroid gland is made up of follicles, the mammary gland is made up of similar, you might say, grape-like or little hollow balls, which are called alveoli. So this is an alveolus. And the mammary gland contains many of these. And as it shows on your handout, the alveolus, which is epithelial tissue, is surrounded by one layer of epithelial cells. So these are epithelial. And they're responsible for making the milk. But then they're surrounded by what is labeled on your handout as a myoepithelial cell. And a myoepithelial cell is like smooth muscle. And it's going to contract in order to eject the milk out. Because remember, the mammary gland is an exocrine organ, which means that it makes secretions and they go through a duct here to the outside, aka baby. So we've already said that this is controlled by oxytocin and prolactin, which control both milk production and milk ejection. So how does this work? If we start up here, when the baby suckles on the breast, there are receptors for their, which are in the nerve endings of cells in the breast. These are the receptor or the sensor cells. And they, when stimulated, send an action potential to the hypothalamus. So this part of the circuit is run by a nerve. And then when the hypothalamus is stimulated, it sends messages to the anterior and posterior pituitary. Now you remember the hypothalamus is really connected to the posterior pituitary. The cell bodies are in the hypothalamus and the nerve endings are in the posterior pituitary. And these nerve endings release either oxytocin or ADH. In this case, we're dealing with neurons that release oxytocin. So oxytocin, the hypothalamus is stimulated. That causes the nerve endings in the posterior pituitary to release oxytocin. And oxytocin stimulates the myoepithelial cells, and it causes them to contract. So whatever milk is in here will be ejected. But of course, you have to make the milk. So the milk production, which is stimulated by prolactin, how does that work? The hypothalamus secretes now a releasing factor, which causes the anterior pituitary to make prolactin. Now, I wrote a releasing hormone here, but the truth is we think there may not even be a releasing hormone for prolactin. We know there's an inhibitory signal. There is prolactin inhibiting hormone, usually called PIH, which, as we mentioned before, is just dopamine. And what it does is to inhibit the release of prolactin. So it's an anti-releasing hormone. Whether there is a positive releasing hormone, we're not sure. But as a result of stimulating the hypothalamus, we either make the hypothetical releasing hormone or we stop making the inhibitory hormone, not some combination. As a result, there's no break on the AP. And now the anterior pituitary releases prolactin, and the prolactin goes and stimulates the epithelial cells, what are called here alveolar epithelial cells, to make milk. So they make milk and secrete it into the lumen. So in response to suckling, you get both more milk ejection and more milk production. That makes the baby suckle more, and around you go. And so as the baby's demands get greater, more and more milk is produced. When the baby slows down or stops nursing, the lack of demand causes a lack of stimulus, and the production of milk is reduced correspondingly. So that's how you keep the demand and the production in sync. Are there any questions about this one before we continue? Yes.
How long does it take to start? I mean, I'm sure it varies from woman to woman.
How long does this cycle take? Well, it's quite fast, but I don't know the exact details, especially the ejection one. If a woman who is nursing even starts thinking about it, she starts to leak. The stimulation of the smooth muscle is almost immediate. Notice that this is a mixture of neuronal. This is neuronal. This part is neuronal, but the rest of it is hormonal. How How long it takes you to make more milk and to keep up is probably a delay of a day, something like that. Yeah.
So, what's the connection then between, like, when you're not pregnant normally this doesn't, or when you're not just having given birth?
When you're not, when there's nobody suckling, nothing happens. But what's interesting about this is that under some very unusual conditions, either men can produce milk, if they get enough stimulation, or a woman who is not pregnant can.
But like when you're pregnant, when you stop nursing, isn't it very difficult to start?
Well, you don't start and stop when you're pregnant, but you mean after you have the baby?
Yeah.
Usually if you stop nursing, it is quite difficult to start again, but you can if you keep at it. The trouble is that the baby's hungry, and so you tend to give the baby a bottle, and then the baby suckles less, and then it doesn't work. Yeah, last question, then we're going to go on. Yeah.
So PIH is always secreted?
Probably PIH, a.k.a. dopamine, is secreted continuously, except when a person is nursing. That's right. Now, we have one more circuit on B, just to tie some loose ends up, and also to give you another example. Now, this is an example of the stress response. We've talked about the idea that epinephrine is produced in response to stress, the fight or flight response, and also that the sympathetic system is in control of your response to stress. And this picture sort of puts it all together. And one way to think about this is that you have three phases of response to stress. The first one is faster, but each succeeding one, although slower, involves more cycles of amplification and probably also lasts longer. So number one is that if you're exposed to stress, as in the famous pop quiz, this is noticed by the brain. And the brain sends a nervous signal to your heart, liver, and adipose. These are the effectors. And they, in response, release either glucose from the liver or fatty acids or other substances, or they just break them down within. So as a result of this, the tissues metabolize more. They also make more fatty acids and glucose available for other tissues to use as a source of energy. Your brain uses glucose, but your other tissues can use fatty acids. This also, of course, increases your heartbeat and has some other effects as well. Now, you notice this is sort of like the post-absorptive state. That is, you break down stored forms and release it so that your tissues will be able to get energy and to function. Now, the second phase of this involves the stimulation not of effectors directly, but of glands that produce hormones, and then those hormones go and stimulate other effectors. So the brain connects to both the pancreas and to the adrenal. But here it's the adrenal medulla, not the adrenal cortex. Now, as a result of this, the pancreas, actually, you inhibit the production of insulin and you promote the production of glucagon. Again, this is like the post-absorptive state, and this is reinforcing what has already happened. One way people think about this is that hormones can reach where nerves don't go. But it takes the hormones longer to get there because the hormones have to go through the bloodstream. So this means that these hormones now are released in the bloodstream. They have much the same effect as the direct stimulation by the sympathetic. And they back it up. But now, in addition, we have stimulated the adrenal medulla. Remember, we said the adrenal medulla is really part of the sympathetic system. And so it produces epinephrine. And epinephrine and glucagon have similar effects on many tissues and that they cause breakdown of stores, release of glucose, etc. And we know epinephrine affects many other tissues as well. Now, in addition, the adrenal, of course, has two layers. It has the adrenal medulla and the adrenal cortex. And the cortex, now, will release cortisol. But it won't do so in response to nerve stimulation. It has to get the tropic hormone, ACTH, or corticotropin, from the anterior pituitary. And this is stage 3. And the way that works, so this is 2. Stage 3 is that there is nerve signaling to the hypothalamus. And that now will allow the hypothalamus to release hormones from the posterior pituitary and to signal, through releasing hormones, the anterior pituitary. So let's look at the anterior pituitary first. The releasing hormone here is going to be corticotropin releasing hormone. That is the hormone that causes the anterior pituitary to make ACTH. And the ACTH now is what's going to cause the production of cortisol. Now, cortisol is a hormone, epinephrine's a hormone, glucagon's a hormone. But cortisol is lipid soluble, and the other two are water soluble. So epinephrine and glucagon are stored in vesicles and released faster. Cortisol is lipid soluble, so you have to make it. You couldn't store it, remember. So you have to make it and release it. But it's a steroid hormone. So what's going to happen is in its target cells, it's going to stimulate, its receptor is a transcription factor, it's going to stimulate transcription and translation. So it's going to have a longer-term effect. It's going to take longer to rev up, but once it starts to work, it's going to have quite a profound effect. And one of the major things that cortisol does is to inhibit the immune system. Now, the immune system's not the only thing that is turned off under stress. The other thing here is part of this, is that the hypothalamic neurons that end in the posterior pituitary, remember, can release oxytocin or ADH. So in this case, these are the ones that release ADH. Now, this helps increase your blood pressure, one of the effects of stress. But the other thing that it does is to reduce the need to urinate because it's anti-diuretic hormone. The assumption being that in a stress moment, you don't want to go. You want to put off going to the bathroom, you want to deal with the crisis, and then you'll go. Similarly, you don't want to deal with wound healing. You want to put that off until later. Now, this means, because of this, cortisol and other glucocorticoids are used, actually, to reduce the immune response when it gets out of hand. One of their major uses is in controlling inflammation, which is a local immune response. It's needed in healing, but sometimes it can get so extreme that it's worse than the insult, worse than the wound. So cortisol and its cousins are used a lot as controlling inflammation. Now, clearly being able to deal with stress is enormously important. If we couldn't do that, most of us would fall apart. Most of us would never have gotten to this stage of our lives, and we would not be looking forward to the next stage. However, too much stress in the long run isn't good for you, in part because it raises your blood pressure, several parts of it do, and because it suppresses the immune system in the long term. So this is an example of some circuit that uses a whole bunch of the different processes and hormones that we've talked about, and that's why I brought it up. So let me ask what questions there are about it before we move on. Yeah?
Just related to the first step there, how would stress lead to weight gain? Because
I'm not sure how stress leads to weight gain. My guess right off the bat would be that in your need for energy, you tend to eat. But we all know that too much stress tends to make you too nervous, and then you tend to nibble. Also, some people say that you need to keep awake longer, and so But exactly how it works, I don't know. There are hormones that affect weight and food consumption, but they have been relatively recently discovered, and exactly how they work is not entirely known. That's leptin, if you want to look it up. Oh, yeah.
We talked about how you can like adjust a set point. Can you adjust the system if you can respond to stress better or worse?
Can you reset the set point so what you perceive as stress is different? I imagine you can, given the difference in behavior of a New York inhabitant and somebody from Nebraska. But I don't know how it works and to what extent. Yes?
If someone is chronically stressed, their body just keeps going.
If their person is chronically stressed, as I understand, they continue to make cortisol. You don't make epinephrine anymore, but you continue to make cortisol. Now, as we've discussed, certain kinds of stress you learn to adjust to. And you presumably no longer produce cortisol. But if what you perceive as stress is continuous, like right now if you work for AIG, I guess, or you're Mattis' lawyer, you are probably secreting cortisol all the time. Okay, two more and then we're going to stop.
If your bladder relaxes when you're under stress, why do people wet their pants under stress?
Why do people wet their pants under stress? I think the reason of that is that the sphincter is not controlled properly. That's the valve, basically, that holds it. Yeah?
Isn't the suppressing the immune system counterproductive to stress? You kind of let everything go and now the body's more susceptible to attacks instead of being able to fight.
Her question is, does it make any sense to let your immunity be down under stress? Wouldn't it make more sense to be super immune? And maybe it would, but I think the answer is that this system is not designed to deal with extremely long-term stress. But the question that she's raised is a very interesting one, is how do you explain the current state of affairs by evolutionary pressures in the past? And sometimes it's pretty easy to do, and sometimes it isn't. And sometimes that tells you how to help yourself along, and sometimes it's no use at all. But there is a branch of medicine called evolutionary medicine, where people try and figure out what are things like fevers, how have they been selected, what have they been selected to help you with, and how can you take advantage of that. Now, I want to talk about one more piece of this that I mentioned earlier, and that's these receptor tyrosine kinase or tyrosine kinase linked receptors. So I want to do that, and then if we have a little time, we'll talk about the kidney. And to talk about this, you want to look at the top of, the bottom, I guess, of B. It's there, right? Yeah. I made a new handout with a new combination of things, so I wanted to be sure we got it right. Okay. I have to get this board before it gets away here. I'll just use the other one then. Okay. So there's another large class of surface receptors, of which the most famous are these tyrosine kinase receptors. And we'll talk about the general idea first, and then we'll focus on them. And the idea is that you have a protein, which if you look at your handout, we've drawn the membrane. Here's the membrane of the cell with the lipid bilayer. And this is top is the outside. This is the inside the cytoplasm. I just drew two lines. But the proteins that make up these receptors are usually single-pass proteins. Sometimes you need a bunch of them to come together. While G-protein-coupled receptors are usually seven-pass proteins. And for reference for later, there is a table in your notes comparing G-protein coupled receptors and tyrosine kinase receptors. Now, in general, so this protein has a cytoplasmic domain, a transmembrane domain and an extracellular domain. And the ligand binding part is in the extracellular domain. And in the intracellular domain, there is usually some catalytic domain. Now, in some cases, the protein itself doesn't have a catalytic domain, but the protein is capable of binding another protein that does. But the bottom line is that when these receptors bind their ligand, the net result eventually is the activation of a catalytic domain on the cytoplasmic side. And that's what's going to trigger signaling within the cell. Now, as we said, the most well-known class of these, the catalytic activity is a tyrosine kinase. Now, what that means, what does a kinase do? It phosphorylates at the expense of ATP. And so that means that what the tyrosine side chains are going to get a phosphate on them. And what's drawn here is how it works. So ligand comes along, and it binds to the extracellular domains of the receptor. And then these types of receptors usually dimerize. So there are two, sometimes more, the two receptor subunits, the two different subunits come together. They can be identical or different, but you get a dimer. Now, this dimerization changes the conformation, the binding of the ligand, and the dimerization activates the catalytic domain. Until this point, the catalytic domain wasn't enzymatically active, but now it is. And what usually happens is that each subunit acts as an enzyme and uses the other subunit as substrate. So if we have the left one here and the right one is going to add phosphates to the left tyrosines, and the left one's going to add phosphates to the right tyrosines. So then you get this final stage that I've drawn here, which looks something like this. Now, what's critical is that this form of the protein, the phosphorylated form of the cytoplasmic domain, now will bind certain proteins. It's sticky, so to speak. It wasn't before. So proteins that were floating around in the cell before and didn't pay any attention, if they bump into this, will stick to it. And those proteins will themselves either be activated or they will become sticky and bind another protein, which will become activated. This may sound familiar. This is that business of recruitment that we talked about once before. And you can get quite a pileup of many, many proteins sticking to each other, forming a very large complex, or you can just get one protein. Now, the proteins that stick to phosphorylated tyrosines tend to have certain domains in common. That is, they all have a certain section of the protein that looks similar. And those, after the way they were discovered, are called SH domains. Now, other kinds of receptors become sticky for a different subset of domains, depending on the type of receptor, etc. But this is the most famous combination. Proteins that contain SH domains stick to activated tyrosine kinase receptors. So what? What happens next? Of the proteins that stick, some of them are themselves enzymes and then can catalyze something, including at least the production of one second messenger. One of the proteins that can stick to the tyrosine kinase is a kind of phospholipase C. Phospholipase C is not really one enzyme, but a family, of which there are many. And one of them sticks to and is activated by tyrosine kinase receptors. Now, what does phospholipase C do? It splits a lipid in the membrane and gives you IP3 and DAG. So that means that you can activate a tyrosine kinase receptor, and it can activate phospholipase C, and now you can get the IP3 pathway. You can get a second messenger. Now, as far as we know, tyrosine kinase receptors do not activate the cyclic AMP pathway. So to put that another way, the cyclic AMP pathway is always triggered by G protein coupled receptors. But the IP3 pathway is sometimes triggered by G protein coupled receptors and sometimes by tyrosine kinase receptors. So this is called a direct effect. Protein binds to the receptor, protein is activated, protein does its thing. But there are many other cases where some protein sticks, and it doesn't do anything except get sticky, and another protein sticks, and it can be a long chain. And the final protein, okay, I'll just make it one, becomes active and does something. So this is called an adapter protein. It's a middleman. It sticks to the activated receptor, and then some protein in the cell sticks to it. And the only job of the adapter protein is to act as a middleman. And by studying various mutants, we've been able to figure out all the parts of this. Now, this protein then becomes active and triggers some event in the cell. The most famous protein in this category is called RAS, from how it was discovered. And it's a G protein. It's a small G protein. You remember what a G protein is? Is that it has a form with GTP that does something and a form with GDP that doesn't. But this is called a small G protein, meaning it doesn't have, it's not a trimer. It doesn't have parts. And this is a very famous, or perhaps I should say infamous protein. And the reason this protein is well known is that many cancer cells have overactive RAS. It's thought that this protein triggers growth of the cell in some way. It controls the cell cycle and perhaps other things. And if you make too much of it, it kicks the cell into dividing when it should not. We now know that many of the causes of cancer are the overaction, the overactivity of proteins that regulate the cell cycle. And when the very last lecture in this class, which is the optional lecture, we'll talk about some more examples of this and how it works. Now, the only, remembering this term is hard because it's an acronym, it doesn't stand for anything, it's hard to, that you know of, what does it mean? There's only one use of this term, RAS, in English that I have ever heard. There's a famous football cheer, which goes, rah, rah, ree, kick him in the knee. Rah, rah, ras, kick him in the other knee. And that's how you remember RAS. Now, this is all I wanted to say about the tyrosine kinase receptors and hormones in general, and I wanted to spend the rest of the time talking a little bit about the introduction to the kidney. So let me answer a few questions, and then we'll do that. What needs the SH domain is the protein that binds directly to the kinase. So that would be, in this case, the adapter. Other questions?
Sorry, but the adapter is the other proteins in between that and the final one aren't the adapters.
Well, if you had a protein that binds to a protein that binds to a protein that does something, you would probably call them all the middlemen adapters.
But the SH is only for the first.
But the first, the SH domain has to be on the first one. But then whatever the adapter protein is will determine what domain is needed to stick to it, and so on. Okay, so I want to change gears considerably and talk a little bit about the kidney. So we're going to introduce today the cell and molecular processes that occur in the kidney. And then next time we will look more closely at the anatomy of the kidney and how all that works to get the kidney jobs done. So you need for this today's handout C. Since we're in a section that has more anatomy, we need more handouts. Now, the kidney is quite a complex structure, but you can think of it as just being one long tubule. Maybe I should say it this way. The active unit of the kidney is a tubule. Many such tubules are packed into a kidney, and the tubules are folded up, all of which we will discuss next time. But if you look at the upper left picture on C, you see that we've drawn something that looks like this. This is one end of the tubule. So the tubule is lined by cells, as we'll explain in a minute. It's entirely lined by cells. And what's going to happen is liquid containing dissolved substances is going to go in one end of the tubule, and then it's going to pass through the kidney tubule, and its composition is going to be modified. And then what you end up, and that's called the filtrate. Because the process by which the liquid gets into the kidney, tubule, is called filtration. And then the composition of the filtrate is going to be modified as this material, as this liquid, moves down the kidney tubule and through the kidney. Some substances are going to be released into the tubule. That's called tubular secretion. That's labeled TS on your handout. And some materials are going to be removed from the tubule and remain by the body. And that's called tubular reabsorption. Now, these are three of the basic processes which take case in the kidney. Filtration, tubular secretion, and tubular reabsorption. Now, notice that the terminology is sort of backwards. Tubular secretion means into the tubule, and tubular reabsorption means away from the tubule. Not by the tubule, but away from. Now, there's one other important process, and that is control of the volume. When you get all finished with this, near the end of the tubule, there will be a certain fixed volume of stuff. And that volume can be regulated, and that's primarily what ADH does, and we'll get to that, how that works. Now, in order for this process to work, liquid has to come from the blood into the tubule. And when you secrete or reabsorb things, either they come from the blood or to the blood. So that's what the rest of that picture is. It shows the blood flow coming in here and then going out again, like this. Now, another way of explaining it is to think about how blood usually works. You have an artery, and that branches into arterioles, or mini arteries, and that branches into capillaries. And the capillaries, remember, don't have smooth muscle. So they have very thin walls, so things can go out between the spaces and sometimes across the wall, across the membranes. But they don't have any smooth muscle around them. And then usually the capillaries rejoin into a venule or a mini vein, and then those join into a venule. Now in this particular case, you have two sets of capillaries. You have one set of capillaries here, and one set of capillaries over here. So if we drew the picture, it would look more like this. And this would be a venule. So you have two sets of capillaries, and one's up here. There's a set of capillaries up here. And that's why this is called the glomerulus. And those capillaries are called the glomerular capillaries. That's these. And substances come out of those capillaries and into the tubule. So they're responsible for filtration. Now the reason it's called filtration is that this barrier here acts sort of like a filter, in that large molecules like proteins do not get out of the blood normally, and they don't get into the filtrate either. So about 20% of the liquid in the blood with dissolved small substances at whatever concentration there are in the blood goes into the tubule. The remaining 80% of the flow goes on. So 20% goes here into the tubule, and 80% is passed on. Now that 80% of the liquid contains all of the proteins. None of the proteins have been lost, none of the macromolecules, but 20% of the small molecules and the volume have been lost. And now you have a second set of capillaries, and if I drew this properly, those capillaries would surround the tubule. And that's what allows for exchange. Material can leave the capillaries and be secreted into the tubule, or things can leave the tubule and be reabsorbed into the capillaries. And so these are called peritubular capillaries. And only after the peritubular capillaries do the capillaries reassemble into a venule and then into a vein and back to the heart. Now, on the bottom of your handout, what's been done is to blow this up a little bit to make it clearer. So on the left, they show you that there's really, this is a cross-section. There's a line of epithelial cells, really, of course, surrounding the tubule. And this is a cross-section. And so if you blow that up, that's how you get this picture. These are the cells. This is the tubule right here. This is the lumen, or the space in the middle of the tubule, same as this. And these are the cells that surround the tubule. Now, this epithelium is polarized, and it's many ways like the epithelium that surrounds your GI tract, that it has a side facing the lumen and a side facing the body. It has an apical side and a basolateral side. So this is the apical or luminal side, and this is the basolateral side. Now, virtually all of these cells have a sodium-potassium pump in the basolateral side. But depending on where they are in the tubule, they have additional other transport proteins. They have channels, they have pumps, and most of the difference is the luminal side, but not entirely. So depending on which channels are available, either things go into the body or things go out of the body into the tubule. And that's shown on the right here, just to make it clear how this is related to the capillary. So the capillary would be over here, and of course the capillary would have thin cells lining it. So how do you get something from either the inside of the tubule to the inside of the capillary, or vice versa? And they've written a bunch of arrows here to make it clear how many processes are involved. That we'll just do it in one direction, that you have to, whatever it is, has to pass the luminal membrane, that it has to go through the epithelial cell, that it has to go out the membrane on the other side. That's 1, 2, 3. Then it has to pass through the interstitial fluid, and then finally it has to get into the capillary, either by going in the spaces between the cells or passing through the capillary cell membrane. So there are 5 steps at getting from the inside of the tubule to the inside of the capillary. Now, needless to say, that's reabsorption. If we wanted secretion, we'd have to do the 5 backwards. We'd have to start over here and go through the whole 5. Now, the picture on the right, which I'm not going to go over, is an example of one possibility. It's the setup for reabsorbing sodium. Because if you have a sodium-potassium pump here on the basolateral side, and you have a sodium channel here, that will pull the sodium in and cause reabsorption. Now, in different parts of the tubule, you have different, as I said, transport proteins, pumps, channels, etc. And what we're going to talk about next time is we're going to draw the actual parts of the tubule and explain what happens in each part of the tubule so that you reduce the volume, adjust the volume, remove, secrete, etc. So you want to bring, you probably don't need that handout, but it can't hurt to bring it. And we'll have another one for the anatomy of the kidney.